Our next speaker will talk about economics of tropical soybean for development, Dr. Peter Goldsmith, the director and principal investigator in the Soybean Innovation Lab, and also he is a professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, in the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics. Pete.
Yeah, so I'll give, while you guys are getting coffee, let me just put on my Soybean Innovation Lab hat on just for a second. First, I want to thank someone, our project manager, Courtney Tamimi, for arranging, doing all, anything you see, especially of quality, Courtney did, okay? Anything that, you know, if there's like a name tag that looks like that was me. So she... just an amazing person, and we thank so much for her. I want to welcome you all and welcome those on the web as well. We're excited to be here. I'm going to take off that Soybean Innovation Lab hat, director hat off, and really just talk about its area that's certainly core to my research program, the economics of tropical soybean. So we'll spend a little bit of time on this, and I think it's important because tropical soybean production, the production economics, differs quite significantly from temperate or high latitude, maybe call it medium latitude, soybean production common in the Midwest, U.S., and Argentina, for example. I didn't realize I wouldn't be able to see the slide. Four walkaway messages. One of them is how important it is to think of and understand the implications of soy as a non-native, non-staple commercial crop. Okay, we might hear these terms, but these are profoundly impactful on the adoption question, the household implications, gender question, and so forth. So it's very important. So that's a walkaway. A second walkaway is that we do know and are very confident about soy being a highly productive protein and oil crop adapted for the tropics. And protein as a scarce macronutrient in the tropics. Most crops are starch crops. This is quite unique and can have profound implications. As Rob mentioned nicely about the economic impact, and we'll talk a little bit about spillovers and soy as part of a system that's an economic engine for rural development. The third point is that I led off with about the economics being quite different, okay, and really compare and contrast, and we'll get into that a little bit more when we compare to temperate soybean economics. And finally, is the point about the need for research, the need to understand this non-staple commercial crop in this new environment of a tropical setting and as a development crop. Before we rush to scale up, we need to understand some very, very basic concepts. And that really was the cool thing behind the USAID issuing an RFP, recognizing the importance of getting a research foundation established for the practitioners, the implementing partners, the consultancies and private sector as they start to scale up and really get on board this soybean revolution. The economics of soybean is a very broad topic, and I'm only, in my area of research, is just a teeny weeny little corner of this. So I'm not going to talk about the economics associated with value chains. And Rob mentioned how important as a commercial crop this is significant implications. Same for seed supply chains. A very, very important area non-trivial challenge to bringing high-quality seed and getting high-quality seed in the hands of farmers. It's a long supply chain. It's an arduous supply chain. And so that's the economics of that are quite important. Another area of research and importance in which, again, I won't talk about at all, is really soy within this economic development context, tied in with the feed industry, input supply, tremendous spillovers, okay? The human development indices where we see tropical soy being produced now are extremely high, okay? So the mapping of soy and human development, so the indicators are quite positive. And then an area that's the domain of a colleague of mine, Jill Findice at University of Missouri, about household adoption in soy and how soy fits into the household portfolio of production crops. This is immensely important for development. Again, that's something that Jill can speak to much better than I can. And then gender that Rob talked about as a priority area. Soy and women-led households, women's decision-making, and how that interacts with the soy production and those decisions. And our colleagues, Kathleen Ragsdale and Lindsay Peterson at Mississippi State, head up a large project looking at the relationship between soy and gender. Finally, policy and competitiveness. This is a large area on the effect on prices, import substitution, and more of the macroeconomics of soy. Again, an area. My area is really on the business side, on the production economics. And so I'm going to talk really about the production function, how soy is grown in the tropics, low-tech versus high-tech, the role of scale economies, something very important in the development context, has huge welfare implications, and then the cost of production, which has great importance. Soy is the fastest growing crop in the world. This is indexed on the year 2000, and soy is that gold line here at the top at about 3% a year since 2000, about 25% faster growth than the second crop, canola, and about a third faster than the third crop, maize. So this is a very high growth crop, and producers are meeting the demand, and production is ramping up. The question, of course, is who? That's the development question. Who's going to produce this? The demand is there. As you can see, most of the high growth crops are starch crops, and so soy has a nice position, a niche to fill. Okay, Rob showed this earlier, the importance of this. You're talking about $126 billion going to farmers worldwide, and it's growing at 3%. Okay, less than 0.5% goes to sub-Saharan African farmers, kind of the target for Feed the Future. And the question is, will they participate, and if yes, how? And that's a major question, and it's a non-trivial question, okay, because it's not straightforward, okay? We see some of the linkage between poultry and soy is very tight. In general, in certain countries, you see poultry, a compound annual growth rate on the first column, and then the soybean growth rate for that country. You look at a country like South Africa, which is a large exporter of soy, has both very high soy growth rates and high poultry growth rates. You see the lower three countries. Again, this is to 2011. So this is a very recent phenomenon, these kinds of growth. The rise of production, for example, in Mozambique hasn't even hit the FAO data set yet, but it will. But you see that poultry growth is far outstripping soy. That means in the case of Ghana, for example, lots of imports of soy. So this is a just showing a very dynamic marketplace right now, very exciting place to be. So soy is a non-native. We want to specify, and the implication for that is that there's very little experience in the agricultural system. That means among agronomists, among plant breeders, among processors, food manufacturers, feeders, formal feeds. For a lot of people, this is a new thing. This is a new thing. Okay. For example, Syngenta did this very cool study from 2009-2012 across six countries, had 10,000 observations of farmers of how they acquire their seeds. Where are they getting, what's the nature of the seed system that supports these farmers? They looked at 32 crops. Okay. None of them were soy. It's just new. It's just new out there, and we have to be humbled by its newness, that we can't be cavalier here. Okay. And this is similar. We're doing, have a curated database of soybean research across all of sub-Saharan Africa, looking at the National Ag Research Database, IITA's great database on research. And when you look at, say, in Ghana, for example, 1/10 of the scientific publications, 10% the amount of soybean versus cowpea, for example. It's just been we have different priorities and historically different priorities. The soy revolution means we need to get on board if the sub-Saharan Africa is going to participate. As a non-staple, this is very important. In this case, I'm just highlighting the role of women. This is a neat study done in Zambia by ACD Ivoca in 2012, and they looked across six crops and five functions and said, is this male determined or driven or female decided? And indexed on ground nuts in terms of women-led decision-making. And it's about 17%. So it's much less, in their survey, women-led in soybean. And that has huge implications for the household, adoption, the nutrition components, and so forth. So gender is a major issue. And we think of, at the household level, labor as a scarce resource. We often think of there's lots of labor, but there isn't. There's competing uses. There's women are being asked to do a lot of things. And can they incorporate soy in their portfolio? Now let's get at a little bit about the technology and the production function and the economics of soy. There haven't been a lot of studies on the actual microeconomics of what farmers actually do when they plant soy in a developing country setting. There have been three studies, okay? One in Ghana on the left, two regions in Sobota and Chirponi, another study that was done in Ghana kind of nationally, and then the Tanzania study. And these are surveys of actual farmers and farmer practices and so forth. And when you look at the inputs that the farmers are using, the little blue area, this little sliver up here, it reflects the inputs. So this would be inoculum, soil correction, fertilizer, fungicide, any other pesticide, insecticide, and so forth. The big brown area in terms of inputs, and this is a major area of kind of academic research about valuing labor is labor. And so you're looking among these researchers, you're looking between 70 and 80% of the cost of producing soy being labor among these smallholder environments, this low-tech approach. Okay? And then you've got these other costs or this red and then this purple over here would be fixed costs. This would be land, depreciation on equipment, things like that. So this is the takeaway here, that this is a low technology system. not surprisingly, very labor intensive, okay, with very few inputs. Okay, so this is a low technology, tropical, you could call production function. Now we've done a lot of work in Brazil, in the low lat soybean region of Brazil, in the state of Mato Grosso, Brazil, and this would be classified as a high technology tropical soybean. So same, you can think of the exact or similar latitude, similar soil, similar germplasm or potential germplasm, but the production function looks quite different. Here, labor is quite small, as you can imagine. And then you've got this big chunk, 50% on inputs. And these inputs, they do not really include seed as a minor component. Okay, so the seed cost for the farmers in Mato Grosso is not very high, especially relative to what producers in the Midwest U.S. pay. This is for inoculum. This is for soil correction. This is for pesticides. Okay, so it's a input intensive in a tropical setting. It's input intensive for these producers. The previous producers, you're looking at yields less than 1,000 kilos per hectare. Here you're looking at 3,000 kilos per hectare in this setting, okay? And more capital intensive, obviously equipment and land. And then finally, do I have it? Temperate, yeah. We go to the U.S. in the Midwest, where I'm from in Illinois. Here, again, similar to the high-tech tropical, low labor input, very high fixed cost, high land, high capital cost. Different from the high-tech tropical and inputs. This is mostly seed. Very low input. Soybean for us in the Midwest is a low input crop, not a high input crop like in the tropics. So that production function is quite different for the high-tech tropical producer compared to the low-tech. Okay, we can look at some costs, okay? And just looking at the costs across these studies, and you see the Mato Grosso study second from the right and Midwest U.S. far to the right, these show up at dramatically different sets of inputs. And one would imagine with dramatically different sets of inputs, you might get or likely get dramatically different sets of outputs and dramatically different sets of levels of profitability. Okay. Interestingly, and this is very important within the value chain context, people want to know about price. Are the markets clearing? Are the markets thick for selling soybean in a developing country setting? What I have here is the price per ton reported by the researchers, US dollars per ton, metric ton in Ghana, for example, is about 98% of the Chicago mercantile cash for that year. It's a strong basis. The demand for soy is there. It's not about selling the crop, it's about producing the crop that's the challenge. We look at profitability. It's depending on how you value labor, it can move around quite a bit. But the high tech, and I point over to the Mato Grosso data, about $175 per hectare net. Okay, there have been several studies that compare low tech and high tech rice, low tech in Burkina, low tech and high tech cotton, low tech and high tech maize, and low-tech and high-tech soybean. The results are probably not surprising. There are just huge differences on technology. So this is a question to wrestle with about the role of high technology, of technology, in soy for development. All the studies seem to be consistent, and in terms of the net and the difference when you add technology in there. We're not talking about biotechnology, we're just talking about inputs. Okay? So finally, let me summarize. So for this non-native, non-staple commercial crop, Clearly, tropical soybean production can be a profitable enterprise. Demand is strong. We've surveyed, we know they can buy, we're working in northern Ghana, the demand for the soy that the farmers produce is there. Very strong. The soybean human development indices, too, can be quite high because you have a very strong value chain with spillovers. You have soybean production, you have inputs, you have transport, you have feed, the feed industry, you have livestock, you have meat production, you have food production, all within the same value chain. And, I mean, in certain settings, you even have bioenergy. And the question is, really, we're working on is how sustainable is low-input soybean versus high-input? And or is there something in between? We really don't, we don't have a lot of research on this. We don't really understand. And what are the implications? And we're very concerned, certainly the social scientists, on the welfare implications. You know, what are the outcomes on livelihoods, poverty rates, and so forth? And it also raises a larger question about labor productivity, about that marginal unit of labor that the woman-led, the woman in the household when she plants a soybean versus a cassava or cowpea or something else. And that is quite an interesting question about becoming more productive to emerge from poverty. How do you make labor more productive? And does soy fit into that? Does soy fit into that? So those are my comments, and I look forward to some questions and discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. We have 20 minutes for questions. We have a question online.
This question is from Dick Tinsley, who is joining us from Colorado. And getting to the points that you were making about labor, he was wondering, when soy is produced by smallholders, will it represent additional area cultivated or a substitution for a crop already being produced? And if it is a substitution, what will it substitute for? And how will that impact the economic analysis?
Right. Yeah, Dick, that's a very good question. And the short answer is I really don't know. And I think we wonder. And I want to, I know you guys, Jill and Lindsay are here. Do you have some thoughts on Dick's very, very important question? If we can get you a microphone if you have some. Yeah, hold up. We got to get you on the mic. Say who you are, Lindsay.
Thanks. Lindsay Peterson, Mississippi State University. Kathleen and I, my co-PI, who is not here today, we did probably 12 or 13 focus groups with farmers in March of this year before we did a large-scale household survey in May and June. I would say just from informally in my brain analyzing the results of our focus groups that it will be a substitution effect, not an additional crop planted. But Jill, do you want to?
Jill Fundais, University of Missouri. I was going to say as well, I mean, we're doing this large survey across both Mozambique and Ghana right now. And we're hearing in the field in some places that there won't be a substitution. That's in Mozambique and Ghana is a different situation, but we will know. And I think that's the important, we should know early in spring what happens there. Okay.
Based on our experience in Mozambique, it's both. In other words, some people use it.
Jake, say who you are.
Jake Walter, TechnoServe in Mozambique. We've done a lot of work with soybeans over the years, and we've seen it go from a very minimally grown crop to 37,000 producers now, mostly smallholders. But the average size of farm is increasing. So there seems to be mechanization and both on the threshing side and the land preparation side that's increasing, it's doing some labor substitution as well as hiring more labor. So people are using various ways to cultivate more land, but also some are staying at the same size and growing some soybeans, so there is some substitution.
Thanks, Peter, for the presentation. I'm Afa from IIT. I'm based in Nigeria. If you are to do the study in Nigeria, you may get a different picture of soybean in West Africa, because the soybean production is more widespread in Nigeria, and then the value chain is stronger. What I'm seeing there, compared to Ghana, Ghana is really low tech, no use of input like fertilizer. But if you come to Nigeria, they are using a lot of input. The soils are very poor for soybean production in West Africa. Low P, all of them across the savannas, including Ghana. So you cannot sustain soybean production in the long run without additional input. And this is really coming down to the smallholder farmers in Nigeria, and they always ask for fertilizer or phosphorus or NPK, and the government is supporting soybean production so that more people will grow. And they're very interesting, more women are showing interest in green soybean, particularly in the Guinea savannas of Nigeria. And what we lack maybe is a study of this type. So if they are doing the studies in Ghana or Mozambique, maybe we may need to collaborate with IIT to perhaps do a study of this kind in Nigeria for you to be able to compare countries in Africa who are using mid-wave, high-tech, and those really doing low-tech. It would be very important for us.
Yeah, super comment. Can I ask you a question? Because it'd be great. Can you share a little bit about credit or how the farmers access the inputs? Are there lots of suppliers of inputs? Do they have access to credit?
It's not much about credit. The soybean processing system in Nigeria is more organized. A lot of the drivers are put to industry and the oil processors. Now in Nigeria, there are many oil processors, process soybean for poultry feed, for also for oil. And because of the middle class, everybody wants to be eating healthy oil. So they are driving the process of creating the demand for soybean production. And that demand is a little bit higher than the other countries, and more people are going to soybean production. Then there's really good market for compound fertilizer and NPK. But what they need is phosphorus. So very few companies are selling also phosphorus fertilizer. For seed, as Kain said, it's a little bit a problem. Farmers are still using their own safe seed. And we see a lot of problem of germination and contamination, physical contamination. So now with the agri programs, the national systems, the government policy of liberating foundation seed production, before it was in the hands of government agencies. Now some seed companies are allowed to produce foundation seed for their own use, and there's some national systems. But still there's a problem because it is not like maize hybrid. So most seed companies prefer the maize to produce maize, not legumes. So most of the external programs that we are having is to support, really kickstart the support for foundation seed production so that we can make that available to the seed companies and also encourage them to sell seed to the farmers.
A question from the webinar. This is from Lloyd LePage in Iowa. He works with Heartland Global Incorporated. And his question was, how can we create improved livestock feed demand and logistics to address filling the demand for smallholders?
Yeah, that's another very good question. You know, and we've been looking at particularly the poultry sector in Ghana, and I know Jake's going to talk about poultry in Mozambique, and as gentleman said, related in Nigeria as well. I mean, the demand side, that pull is essential. And the organization of poultry production and the movement of capital to poultry production is a more feasible, reasonable process than capital moving to soybean production. It's for a number of reasons, technological reasons and intensification reasons, use of capital, there are a number of reasons. So that's makes the poultry pull more feasible, but also essential. And so in that level of activity and getting the poultry producers organized, getting them to I wish our colleague Mike Lacey was here from University of Georgia, thinking about nutrition, switching poultry producers to formal feeds. Local poultry, there's a lot of local poultry production as well, smaller scale, using formal feeds and higher quality proteins like soy. These create tremendous local demand and engaging small and medium holders. But a dynamic poultry sector and a poultry sector that is thinking in terms of formal feeds, engaged with the feed industry, modern rations and so forth becomes essential.
Thanks, Ahmed. Rob Bertram, Bureau for Food Security. I just wanted to share two comments, the first purely anecdotal, the second less so. A couple of years ago when we were just starting out in this endeavor, I spoke with John Edgar, who's some of you may know, he's the lead of our Feed the Future team in Malawi. And John told me something that I really was music to my ears. And that was that if a farmer in Malawi had a bag of soy, he or she could sell it. In other words, the market was going to make its way to them. And that was very interesting to hear that. And I just mention it now in reference to the last question. More recently, though, and perhaps more significantly, Tom Jane, who some of you may know from Michigan State University, has been talking about, if not yet documenting, what he perceives as a real revolution in African agriculture in terms of market penetration. And we need to zero in on this, and our policy people are thinking about it, and Tom's been to the Bureau, three times, I think, in the last few months. But I think that we can think about information flows, particularly cell phones, in terms of exchanging information, infrastructure, continuing to incrementally improve, and perhaps most importantly, particularly for this particular endeavor, the growth of wealth and the shift in diets associated with that in cities in particular. So, it's an exciting time. And I think you all are going to be at the forefront of understanding the dynamics of how these things come to bear on an emerging crop like soy.
Thank you.
Another question from the webinar. This one is from Surendra. And the question is, Dr. Goldsmith, can you share some of your experiences or findings in terms of how seed is managed in soybean innovation lab countries where you're working? And a second question is, or is access to improved seed a factor in the rate of adoption?
Yeah. No, it's a significant constraint. And we also have good experience from Brazil on how they generated germplasm for the low-latitude tropical producers, really a focused effort not that long ago in the mid-1990s became quite aggressive. And the management and the investment is absolutely essential. Soy is very sensitive to photoperiods, to the latitude, to soils and pest pressures and so forth. So adapted seed is critical. So you start there. When you look at the system, and I probably should have Ken give his not that long, but a substantial history and relationship with producing soy germplasm and sending it through the system, working with the National Ag Research organizations at the various countries. There's a tight relationship between IITA and the NARS, the National Ag Research System, and this is very, very important. IITA has brought a lot of germplasm in from the U.S. And Brazil over the years, developed their own and worked very closely, and every year send out large quantities of breeder seed out for development among the NARS. The NARS breeders themselves are very active trying to advance and develop adapted varieties, and also this filters through to the private sector. We had a very interesting meeting down in Lusaka with the private sector and public sector, all the major soybean breeders in Zambia. And it was very interesting that the struggle with access to high-quality breeder seed and getting increasing that turnover, because it's a numbers game. You need large volumes. And so that system from IITA and the National Ag Research System, as well as the partnership with the private sector, becomes very, very essential. But basic questions about seed labs, seed storage, maintaining germination, profitability for the private sector so that they'll invest in soy, these still remain. So these are basic questions that the breeders have access to the technology to store the seed, to test the seed, to understand and differentiate one seed from another. Very important issue that Hailu and I've talked about, very, very important, about varietal testing and the transparency about one variety versus another. This is a very important feature of a successful seed system. So it's a large problem, a very essential problem to tropical soybean development.
Great. Another question from the webinar. Lots of questions coming in. This one is from Subramanayam, and apologies if I'm mispronouncing your name. And the question is, similar to the Brazilian context, does the Soybean Innovation Lab look at the African situation, specifically in the change from subsistence smallholder farmers to large-scale farmers?
Yeah. The process, clearly there's a difference. And it comes down, certainly the access to land is quite different in the African context to the situation I'm familiar with in Mato Grosso, in Brazil. And so that's a big difference. The situation in Mato Grosso was a very called organic process. It was one where the farmers had access to land, and they determined what the appropriate scale, technology, and so forth, and went forth. They did not have government assistance. They had access to land, and essentially that was it. They don't have infrastructure. So it's a very organic process. But the access to land was certainly fundamental. The adoption of technology is also quite important. So that experience, and I think it's quite telling, because the tropical environment is so hostile. And so somehow smallholders, to be able to be competitive, do need access, as the gentleman from IITA was saying earlier, access to technologies so that they can compete. It does seem to be, those seem to be the two major lessons that we can, when we compare and contrast the Brazilian and the sub-Saharan African situation.
Hello, I'm Tola Nivibad from Michigan State University. I was just wondering, I'm originally from Sri Lanka, and I was wondering whether you've ever considered soybean as a human food, because in where I come from, we have textured vegetable protein that is very, very popular. And I know, in the U.S. they have edamame, there are edamame snacks, so I was wondering if that was something that anybody has looked
right
into.
Yeah, we have a number of experts, much more expert in this than I here in the room, and they can certainly chime in as well. Yeah, so soy for human food is of great interest and has been a very active area of research. At the National Soybean Research Laboratory, University of Illinois, other places as well. The usage of soy, certainly in South Asia and in Southeast Asia, for human use, much more prevalent and common in culture than in Africa and in Latin America and in Central America. But there are some great examples of soy for human use. The implementation of vitigoats, soy cows for soy products, soy entrepreneurship. So there are many, many examples out there of successful usage. So within the Soybean Innovation Lab, Craig Gunderson and Marilyn Nash, oh, there's Marilyn, there are the PIs on soy for human nutrition. So I'd let them add anything they want to add.
Hi, this is Marilyn Nash with the University of Illinois National Soybean Research Lab. And yes, part of the managed research area 5, I think it is, within SIL, we will be looking at how soy cows can make soy milk and foster community and enterprise development. And we will be working within the home-based processing systems to see if we can teach people in the communities how to process soy into either soy milk, soy flours, and using whole cooked soybeans in their daily meals. And we'll be tracking that to see how well they can adopt those techniques and technologies.
One last question.
Tom Shaw from CRS. Actually, it's not so much a question as a comment. In northern Benin, we have a home industry with a lot of our savings groups of making soy cheese, which is tofu. And actually, it's a huge money-making. Most of the ladies can earn as much as $300 a year simply on the, net benefit of $300 a year simply by soy food, and it's in all the markets. I don't know how much you people travel, but I travel a lot. And a lot of the meat in the markets, I really wonder what it is and how long it's been there. So I'm a firm supporter of all of these ladies with little industries of buying the cheese because it's deep fried, which isn't the greatest way to do it, but it still is very tasty and spicy, and then I don't have to worry about the protein source that I'm eating when I'm up there. And I know it's not in your project, but since I've been asked to look at this, I've been kind of wondering why not. The region in northern Ghana you're looking at is very, very similar in terms of what they eat and what they do is in northern Benin. And we didn't do this. CRS introduced soy about 20 years ago and was for feed or something like that. But that isn't where the industry went. The industry has gone to tofu. And, they just call it cheese. And it's really amazing that you see these vast pots that are almost the size of this table in villages, cooking it up and fermenting it the whole time, and they sell it every fifth day. There's a market every fifth day in the area. It's just an incredible source of both protein, because people consume it, and an incredible source of revenue to the women. So I don't know what you've looked at up there, but I think this area is very similar and could benefit from a visit to ladies in northern Benin. It's not quite the same languages, but they would benefit from something like that. So just thought I'd throw that out there.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you so much, Pete.
Okay, thank you.